I'm serving a purpose. I'm feeding life. And I'm broken apart, and all the littlest pieces of me are just recycled, and I'm billions of other places, and my atoms are in plants, bugs, the animals, and I am like the stars that are in the sky. There one moment, and then just scattered across the goddamn cosmos.
Hello and welcome back to The Monologue. Here at The Monologue, we are a podcast that does a deep dive into the works of Mike Flanagan, exploring reoccurring motifs, creative processes, collaborations, and of course, The Monologue. Today we have a very, very special guest with us, Jamie Flanagan.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, welcome.
Jamie. Yeah, welcome.
Producer, actor, award-winning writer.
I feel like if I walked into a room with my brother and called myself a producer, he'd laugh at me. But I'll take the other ones. They all sound great.
That's what brothers are for, though. I am also a big brother, and we're just here to knock you down a peg.
I love that. I'm in. Let's go.
No, it has. It's so we've been podcast internet friends for a bit now, and it has been absolutely thrilling just to watch the way your career has progressed, even in like the couple of years knowing you.
Oh, thank you, Riley.
Jamie Flanagan on the like people to watch out for, you know, Forbes list, whatever.
You're hearing it here, folks.
Hopefully watch out for me in a good way. Yeah, I could be taken too very well.
You never, oh no.
I guess we should, podcast host, we should introduce ourselves. My name is Cecilia. I am also joined by Riley and Kelsey. Say hi.
Hello. And
the theme of our episode today is going to be existential horror. So we're going to talk all about faith, death, the unknown, and how it kind of pops up in the Flaniverse. So I guess before we jump into that, let's jump back into Jamie. Is there anything you want to tell the people right up top? What have you been working on?
Oh, I can talk about this because it already leaked. So I can't possibly possibly get this wrong. So I'm working on Carrie with the rest of the Flanagan clan over at Amazon. It's going to be a series adaptation. I probably can't say more about it than that. Yep, you know, so we're in the writer's room for it. I'm not even sure if we have a green light yet in terms of, but I think we might, maybe. I don't know, they talk about things that, like, we're moving forward, so we're probably moving forward, but that's probably as detailed as I can get into that without getting myself into unnecessary trouble.
That's okay. Hopefully once it is out in the world, we'll have you back on and then we can, you know, spill all the tea about what happened with Carrie.
That would be lovely. It's been a really nice process. The room is comprised of a lot of folks that you're already familiar with from Justina Ireland, Danny Parker, Alon Gale, Rebecca Klingel, Elizabeth Padden is new to us as our head of the writer's room and is doing just a lovely job. Yeah, you know, it's a really good group of people. Got a lot. I mentioned Alon Gale's in there too, and I think all in all, we're going to have a really, really solid take on the material, which I'm excited for people to get a chance to take in.
Yeah, very exciting, and I'm sure we'll see the same on screen if I'm assuming correct.
Yeah. Ooh, big one. I almost neglected to mention Mike's longtime assistant, Alex Magistro, who herself is also a director and a writer, and extremely talented. This is her first staff writing gig, it's pretty incredible to see Alex step up. She's she just has an incredible instincts, and it's just really a joy to see her work she'd been so sort of supportive in other rooms before, and has always, I think, had a very strong creative voice. And now she actually gets to say that without having to, like, couch it in an apology. You know, it's really nice.
I was fortunate enough to see her short film at the Overlook Festival a couple years ago, and it was amazing. It blew me away.
Oh yeah, the title. It's called.
Is it Love You Mama or I Love You Mama?
I think it's Love You Mama. That's it. It's great, isn't it? Like Samantha Sloyan is wonderful in it, and I thought that Alex's direction was really sharp. And that was it Matt Blydell, I think, is opposite Sam in that one.
Yes, and I can't remember the actress who plays like the daughter, but everybody in it was amazing, and like the plot and the I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil it, but it was really good.
Yeah, I loved that one too, and I think between that and some stuff coming up, which I don't know that I should probably talk about. I think Alex is going to have a really good next year or three. So I think it's going to be a good time to watch out for her. She's somebody to watch.
All right, we'll put her on the list. Oh, Jamie, I have not gotten a chance to watch yet, but it is like directly next on my watch list. The Peacock show that you worked on, Hysteria. Thank you. With, Anna Camp.
Yeah. Anna and I go way back.
I haven't seen anything about that online or anything. And I, from what I've read, I've heard it's great.
Yeah, you know, it came out around Halloween. Anna and I go back about 20 years, right out of college when I was still doing theater. One of the first professional gigs I got was a sort of Laramie Project-esque telling of the Columbine shootings called Columbinus. It was a devised piece that premiered at Roundhouse in D.C., and then we ended up doing it at Perseverance, Alaska, and then finally at New York Theater Workshop. Right off Broadway. And that was where I met Anna. Anna joined the cast in New York. And so, yeah, we did that whole run together. And if you had told me that 20 years later, I'd write on a series that she got to be one of the leads in, and I'd get two scenes with her as an actor myself in that series, I would not have believed it. It was wild. So, yeah, when I got to work with her on set, It was just a joy, you know, like it was just an absolute joy. I really love the show, and I'm really thrilled at the reception that it got from the folks who watched it. You know, it's tough to get people sometimes to tune in, I think, to any series that doesn't really have steam under it yet, you know?
Yeah.
But this is a good one. It's set during the Satanic Panic. It's a first-time creator, Matthew Scott Kane, and co-running with him was David Goodman, both of which are just incredibly talented individuals and kind, which makes me want to see them succeed even more. The cast is nuts. We got Bruce Campbell in there. We got Barbara Crampton. We got Jeff Combs. We basically just raided, you know, kind of cult horror and brought all our favorites with us, and it's a really fun series. Garrett Dillahunt plays our villain and does just a beautifully nuanced job with it. I would love it if more people got a chance to see that series, and I hope that they do. So if you don't have Peacock yet and you're looking for a reason, I'd recommend it for that. And also, I'm about four or five episodes into Day of the Jackal, which I'm loving. The series adaptation of that with Eddie Redmayne.
Him.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, it opens with a Radiohead needle drop, so then I knew I was in good hands. It's like, yay, somebody remembers
when
the 90s.
Good, you know that, you know, you're in for a treat, which is how I felt about Midnight Mass, segueing into...
Oh, our actual topic. Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want...
To be fair, we framed it around. We're not talking about the topic for a second, so I think it's fine.
Oh yeah, of course. Don't mind me. I'm quite silly, and I'll probably make a ton of jokes that only I think are funny. I have a history of this. So
we're all nerds here. I feel like we'll have some understanding, some shared humor, hopefully.
Lovely.
We're all just a bunch of weirdos trying to make it through this.
Yeah, I found that this has helped me get through this. This is Tom Holland's fake beer.
What do you got there? You're a little blurry at the moment. Yeah,
it's called, what was it, Biro, which is a fake beer, non-alcoholic beer, that Tom Holland made. Yeah.
Oh, I just heard about this.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's really nice. He's got like three different flavors. You know, he's got like an IPA, he's got like a wheat flavor, and then just like a basic Pilsner. The Pilsner is my favorite. And apparently the Pilsner, I think he named after, it's like Kingston Pilsner, I think, that he named after his hometown. I might be getting that mixed up with the Edge Hill IPA. But yeah, as non-alcoholic beers go, highly recommend it. So if you're looking for something like decent and non-alcoholic, go for it. Tom only paid me, you know, like $500 to say this. So for him, it was like a $5 bill. But
wow. Yeah. You could have milked it for at least $1,000.
Absolutely. Next time, I'll be like, show me some of that Marvel money. Show me that Spider-Man Sony money. Let's
just
see.
Just comes me in one of my projects vaguely dressed as Spider-Man.
I would adore that, but I would also insist on Andrew Garfield being there because I'm just a huge Andrew Garfield nerd. Oh, if I have a spider person present, I feel like that's who I want.
I want him around all the time. I feel like that's reasonable. He's gorgeous and hilarious.
And talented. Oh my gosh.
Oh, and insanely talented.
Yeah. Absolutely.
He's so good in Tick, Tick, Boom.
It's a great one.
Oh, speaking of.
Oh, whoa. Wait, did you guys plan that?
That wasn't planned at all.
Insane.
I love that. That's amazing.
Like I said, a bunch of nerds are here.
I love this for all of us, and I feel at home and safe with you. So thank you for being all of your wonderful selves.
Oh my god, I feel exactly the same. That's why we keep begging you to come back, and thankfully you have been so gracious every time.
Look, I don't have much to do. It's this, video games, or writing. And so, you know, I'm always happy to come talk with people when I'm not just recharging my social batteries by playing Baldur's Gate 3 for the 900th hour.
Well, that's healthier than all the doom scrolling that I have been doing. It's what
should
is
we talk the, about?
The 30th of January.
Horror?
Yeah,
yeah.
Can we talk about the horrors of it all?
Yeah, let's do
the horrors of the unknown for sure. Not really knowing what's coming up.
Yeah,
yeah. I think one theme. And obviously the theme that we're talking about today about this existential horror, especially around death, the unknown, and how faith kind of plays a part in that, is something that, although we have picked a couple works that we're going to talk about, I think you can see it in a lot of the Flaniverse, a lot of the works that both Jamie and Mike Flanagan do. But also I think it's such a universal topic for everybody, because I feel like that's got to be the number one question of humanity, right? What happens to us when we die?
Yeah, you know, that's certainly one that Midnight Mass and especially Mike dive into in the dueling monologues, right? And Riley and Aaron's scene there. What happens to us when we die? Yeah, I get the existential fear of that, and that we don't know and we can't know, and we can, you know, hypothesize about it for whatever reason. And maybe it's just because I'm somewhat shallow. I'm still just more terrified of everyone around me than death. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I worry more about what I don't know about, strangers and their intentions towards me and people I love, then I worry about actually dying. Dying doesn't frighten me so much. Living scares the crap out of me.
Well, and I feel like as the two trans people in the room, it's very heightened after the last 30 days or 10 days, honestly. It's only been, I can't believe that.
Yeah, it's a lot, you know.
So it kind of takes the focus off of.
No, please. I don't think we can really talk about dread without speaking to the moment, and the moment now, at least in the United States of America, for immigrants, for trans people, for women, for minorities, is one of uncertainty and fear. And that's fear of any number of things, right? A lot of us don't even know which direction the next attack is going to come from. Whether it's, you know, taking much needed medicine off the board, whether it's persecuting teachers for recognizing gender identities, whether it's deporting 30,000 immigrants to, Guantanamo Bay. Every day is a fresh horror in our current administration. And I think if you're feeling afraid or sad or depressed, that's proof positive that you're an empathetic human being. So good on you, and I'm sorry, and at least we're all here together.
All And we all
right.
take a deep breath.
Yeah, I think we all
Breathe it out.
Yep.
Well, and as these four people in the room, I feel like we've got, I work with adults with developmental disabilities. Kels is a teacher. Cecilia's getting, everywhere around you is on fire. It's just
Literally.
literally, yeah, out in California. And it's just the people who say things like they don't pay attention to politics or it doesn't affect them is just so. I don't know how you could be so unaware or selfish or apathetic or
Yeah.
whatever it is that makes them
I
that way.
think there is a certain, not forgiveness, but empathy I do have for some people who are actually say that legitimately. Because I think, especially given the economic climate in our country, like if you're a single mother working 2.5 jobs and you're trying to take care of kids, it's like I literally don't have enough mental power in the day to think about those things. There's something that Philip DeFranco says that I always think about, which is, if you don't fuck with politics, politics are gonna fuck with you.
That's true. Regardless of your position or, awareness, it still affects us constantly. And
That's
I
over.
would like to throw out a softball question to kind of shift gears. So, Jamie, what do you think happens when we die?
Oh,
I'm so
obviously
sorry.
I have no idea,
I
but today this changes a lot depending on any number of circumstances or moods or events, but today I feel like maybe it's just over and that's okay. Maybe it's just full stop gone. And I think there might be a mercy to that. Sorry, kids, I'm a little depressed today. But thank you
That's okay.
for
Well,
indulging me.
you were raised Catholic, right?
Yes, Mike and I both,
As
we did the
a
altar boy thing. We did Catholic grade school, Catholic high school.
Yeah.
Sunday school, we did religious retreats at Camp Maria in the summers. We were as instilled with as many religious ideals as any two people could be, between birth and the age of 18.
As a former Catholic myself, how do you think that affects, speaking about faith, do you think that has, obviously it has a big effect, but how do you think that has effect on both like how you perceive like what an afterlife might be, but also like your writing? Do you think that you sometimes write something and go, oh, I think I know why I wrote that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that kind of a background, especially in the earlier years, instills you with an idealism and a sense of moral justice that unfortunately, a lot of times these religions, so they teach them early, they don't follow through with them in practice the older that you get. So you have that foundation of a sense of fairness and a sense of justice and a sense of the way that people should be treated with kindness and, love thy neighbor and all that. I think by the time you get to high school, maybe college, the disillusionment starts to trickle in. And I think for a while, and I'll speak in general terms, and of course, this may not apply to everyone, but maybe there's a period of bitterness that follows the disillusionment, a sense of betrayal, in that a lot of these things that you were raised to believe and to practice aren't really applicable in the way that people treat each other in the world. And that isn't to say that kindness isn't applicable. It's to say that kindness isn't often practiced by the heads of these organizations. Empathy isn't often practiced by many of its members. And when you point that out to them, they act like that was, never the point. It's, you get those memes of Jesus holding like a semi-automatic weapon, or something like that. And you kind of have to be like, yeah, I get the joke. It's because this person was supposed to be about love, and obviously they've been twisted to be a little bit something more, the intersection of politics and religion. Politics really won and kind of dragged religion behind it. You know, you get people who were raised with do unto others as they would do unto you, and now they're posting things on the internet like, you know, do not commit the sin of empathy. I think I saw that on a meme the other day. You chuckle, you laugh. I do too, because it's that or scream, right? It's the strangest thing. So there's an anger, there's a bitterness, then there's an understanding. I think that blooms after that. You work through the anger, you work through the bitterness. Not that it ever goes away. These things come in waves, right? But hopefully after that, there's an understanding, a recognition of how these things have gone off the rails, and a hope that maybe you can right the ship. And by that, I don't mean like steer an organized religion to peace, but I mean like steer a family member or a loved one who's gone a little bit more Jesus with a shotgun and twist them into more of, hey, maybe Jesus with forgiveness, if you can get them back to that version of it. And then I think there's another way of disillusion when you realize most of the times you can't. Not even the people that you love the most, who are with you for the longest, who, you know, helped instill these ideals into you, if they don't want to make that shift, they're not going to. And there's nothing you can really say to them. There's no argument you can bring to them that they haven't already rationalized. To bring it back to the monologue, one of the times where I really got to dive into this was Father Paul's sermon about moral relativity. This is one I'm happy to take credit for. I got to write this one in isolation. Yeah, you know, talking about how in this war of life, conscience is king, you know, that this is this God-given thing. So if God gives you a conscience, and conscience is supposed to dictate right or wrong, and you do something, if it doesn't feel wrong, then it must not be wrong, because otherwise God would instill guilt. And, you know, I think that's something that we can recognize today in many people who tend to walk around and wield religion as a weapon instead of as what it was meant to be, which is a bomb, BALM.
I think what you said, it makes a lot of sense. I definitely relate as someone who used to be Catholic, who my parents are still Catholic. It's weird to say like they're like my dad's probably gonna listen to this. They're like, I call them cafeteria Catholics, where they like pick and choose. So they pick all the nice things, but they kind of ignore the bad things. Like when I decided to stop being Catholic, my mom stopped bothering me about it when I said, well, once I can reach a role that's higher than a nun in the church, maybe I'll consider coming back. She couldn't really fight that.
I feel like
That
your
was
parents would make great Episcopalians. I'm surprised that we
probably.
haven't thought about that for them. But, you know, people are stubborn in their way
but.
and they love to double down, which is why people get stuck in this QAnon loop that
Yeah,
we've
and
been
I
talking about.
and I don't think lowercase religion is bad. It's the uppercase. It's the organized. I think Midnight Mass, for example, does a really good job of showing both sides of how religion can both be, like you said, a balm, but also can be a weapon. No more is that clearer than in the current world.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and I love what you said about religion with capital R versus lowercase. I feel like, given how often the word humble appears in doctrine, and how often people sort of lift the word humility out of religion and hold it up as an ideal, religion really should be a lowercase R. It should be something that you hold deep and personal to yourself and within your community, but that you use to enrich the lives of you, the people you love, and the world around you. And if it starts, you know, leading you with a capital R to do things that are much more sort of loud, drastic, and harmful, it maybe isn't the most useful thing that the world needs right now.
Kelsey, you got any religious trauma?
Well, I mean, I was raised as a Catholic, but then my family moved to Georgia, and the conservative of I'm trying to think of a nice way to say this, but basically, like the town that we moved to, a lot of the people remind me of Bev Keane. Like I watched Midnight Mass, and I was like, oh, that is my daily experience like the scene in the schoolroom when the sheriff, I was blanking on it, Sheriff Hassan, right?
Oh,
Was his,
Hassan and
yeah.
Karen when they're
Was having that like kind of discourse with Bev, and he was explaining about how like if you're gonna teach religion, you need to teach like all different religions, not just yours. And she was like kind of like she like did not understand that. Like that was very much my experience like moving to the South. I connected with that a lot, and I definitely see like the two different types of like within Midnight Mass, you have Aaron who like actually does use religion as like a balm, and then you have Bev Keane who like thinks that she is the most religious, but in some ways she is actually probably the least religious.
yeah, I agree. And I think that Bev Keane is a recognizable monster in the same way that what was Mrs. Carmody from The Mist is. And there's a long tradition of just religious zealotry that dates back probably since the concept of God came about, right? There's always someone who believes so much that they're willing to trample everyone around them to hold tight to what it is that they've come to accept as the one truth. And I think once you pigeonhole yourself into one truth, it becomes harder to be empathetic. Because where's the humility in looking at the rest of the world and saying, well, all of you are wrong, but I have the one inside line to the most powerful being in the world who forgives me, but not you. Once you get there's not much humility left to be had.
And the thing is, like, none of us knows because we don't know what happens. Like, no one knows definitively what happens after we die. And so no one can say, like, oh, I'm right about this. So that makes it even more, like, I guess, infuriating or maybe like comical even.
Yeah, it's interesting. We talk a lot about faith being an act of bravery, right? Wholesale buying into something you can't prove, but we don't maybe talk as much about the virtue and the humility in admitting that you don't know and can't know. I feel like embracing that uncertainty, even though it is frightening to say, I'm not guaranteed a place in paradise when I die. I just have to live on earth and try to do my best here, be kind to myself and be kind to others for no reward and no punishment at the end. I think that's a different kind of bravery, but maybe we should lift that a little higher.
My girlfriend is like a literal card-carrying Buddhist. They gave her a card after her ceremony,
Oh,
but
wow.
I've looked a little more into like Taoism since then, and I think it's a very like Taoist thing to just be able to say, I don't know, and move on. It's what I've been trying to do this year, and it does seem just so freeing rather than having to have all of the answers. And I think that's how a Bev Keane is created, and I don't know what it is in our psychology that makes us want to double down and always be right, but I think that's just a, practice that a lot more people need to be practicing.
Yeah, I think you're
Get
right.
off
I
damn
agree.
internet, kids.
Yeah, right. It's the
Ugh.
loudest voice in the room with the most sure opinions is usually the one that I tend to want to take a bit more space away from.
Yeah, I think there is a certain amount of fear though when with religion. I think it is it's so hard because you can't really determine if somebody really believes what they believe. Kind of like Bev. Like I don't know if she ever really believed in it, but like the power she got from it. But there is a certain sense that like especially when people get older, they turn more to faith because you're just getting so much closer to like the end, so to speak. Is it easier to just go along and try to pretend there might be an afterlife, even if deep down you know there might not be?
Have you guys heard of a thing called Pascal's Wager?
I have not.
Okay. So my friend Nick actually introduced me to this because his mother-in-law or somebody is basically one of those people who decided, I don't believe in this. I have never believed in this. But just in case it is real, I will go to church. I will do all of these steps. I will do whatever it takes for me to get into heaven at the end of it. But the problem is, it's a faith-based religion. You don't have that faith. So why are you practicing this when you can, like, literally never believe it? Like, Jamie, if I told you right now, believe in God, do it.
Yeah. Sadly, that wouldn't take.
You can force yourself. I think faith is so interesting that, like, contradiction of that, you know, belief or those actions.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. Look it up if you would like to be more educated than the vagueness that I remember.
Absolutely. I think similar to that idea of whether or not you believe it, you do the thing to get the desired end just in case. I think there is a more immediate side to that coin that's a little bit less of an intellectual wager. As we age, we accumulate, just by virtue of being people and stepping on each other's toes, we accumulate shame. And I think that the older we get and the more shame we acquire, depending on our ability to process that in a healthy way, that makes religion very attractive. If you're estranged from family members and you regret it, if you hurt an ex that you wish you hadn't, if you had friends that you talked ill about, something like that, and it had dire consequences, and you have no way to mend those fences, or you just don't have the accountability to do it, some religions offer you a get-out-of-jail-free card, where if you say you believe, you can walk into a room with a stranger, tell what you did, and that person will literally absolve you of the sin and the shame. And then you can walk out, and you're supposed to be able to feel completely unburdened. I see the appeal. Point right to Midnight Mass and right to Riley on that one. It's something that I think about a lot when I think about AA, and I think Alcoholics Anonymous is great. It is very faith-centric, the big book there. I think what you sometimes get in a worst case scenario is someone who takes the meetings and brings God into their life and absolves the shame and then stops going to the meetings, but keeps the device that keeps letting them off the hook. And so they go out into the world and find that even though they are continuously told that they are absolved of shame, they still feel it. So they direct it outwards. And they cling on to the religion part of it that says it has a certain set of rules, certain set of dogma, and if they follow that dogma religiously, for lack of a better word, the more fervently they go after it, the more they prove that they don't deserve shame. I think that's where you get a lot of persecution of minorities, of LGBTQ plus folks. I think it comes from that sense of us and them, the oldest story there is, that basic conflict. How do I make myself feel better? And sometimes the easiest way to do that, unfortunately, people have found is to trample someone else. It's sad, but there it is.
On the flip side, too, though, I think there is a certain really nice quality about lowercase religion. That is, there is a sense of community. And I think as, very social creatures, I think you see it a lot with the beginning of Midnight Mass and you see it on Crockett Island. Like, there's just this beautiful community. I think especially for people as they get older, you're losing your friends, you're losing family members, your kids aren't around as much. I think there's something that going to church can really provide you. I think as long as you're not obviously using your religion as a weapon, and I, obviously we're not broad stroke painting everybody, but it's just, the weapon ones are very loud right now.
Yeah, it really is. It depends on like the guidance that you are getting from these religious leaders, because I know a guy who recently just wanted to get back in the community, wanted to work on his drinking, ended up at one of those MAGA churches, basically manipulated him to keep coming back by, providing him with food and things like that, but then pumping his head full of this insane ideology that never existed in his mind before. And then on the opposite end of that, my girlfriend and I were just experiencing this. She moved to a new town. We started going to I keep mixing the words of this up, but a Unitarian Universalist church. And that has been phenomenal. That has been what I have wanted out of religion, which is just a lot of people practicing their own individual beliefs together and just coming together as a community to help and kind of as sermons, just telling these stories and fables or whatever that are like, just like guided wisdom. It's very, very nice. And I wish that more religious institutions would take cues from them.
Yeah, I think that's religion at its best. And to go back to what Cecilia was talking about, you know, that sense of community. Loneliness is such an epidemic, and apparently more so on the rise these days, after the advent of social media, that having that sort of community is invaluable, especially as we age. So if I'm speaking very negatively about religion, I should be very careful to say that I don't want to paint it all with that broad a brush. Right. There's beauty to be found out there, like, and kindness. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and comparing it to Bev Keane, I think anyone who's seen Midnight Mass knows the kind of religion
we're speaking of course.
But I think the interesting thing about faith, though, is it doesn't necessarily have to be religious. I think you could have faith in your friends and your family. You can have faith in scientific discoveries that are happening. You can have faith in humanity in general. I think a lot of really bad, powerful people have a lot of power. But I think there are a lot of good people in the world. Like, even something as simple as, like, I was doom spiraling with my boyfriend the other day, and then I was like, you know what? We could see the end of tuberculosis in our lifetime thanks to the work of, like, John Green. And, like, that's a miraculous thing. There is good in the world. And so it does kind of instill a certain amount of faith in you. And I think you can kind of see that in Midnight Mass. Hassan might be Muslim, but, you know, the people who rally around him have faith in him.
Yeah, yeah, I absolutely agree.
I would love to say just my favorite thing about Midnight Mass, and I was reading through I think episode 7, the screenplay, earlier, and just that scene of, like, the deviants, basically, like Hassan and Sarah and Aaron coming together and, like, being the ones trying the hardest to save everyone from this epidemic that is happening with the, you know, vampirism. It's just very nice to see that just because you aren't religious, or because you got pregnant out of wedlock, or because you are queer or whatever, you still have just as much value and you can still do so much good as an individual. And it's just a very, very beautiful message. And the show actually scared me more than most things have ever scared me in my life. But I keep going back to it because the message behind it is, it's just stuck with me ever since I watched it.
It's a beautiful piece.
Actually,
yeah.
Speaking of, there was a phrase you used earlier about something about firing missile silos. And I don't think we told you, but at the beginning of every episode, we take a clip or a full monologue from one of the shows in the Flanniverse. And the one that I pulled for this week is actually Riley's What Happens When We Die speech from episode 4, I believe. And that was a specific phrase that I remember reading when I was reading through his monologue. Did you have anything to do with that?
No. Those two monologues, the dueling Aaron Riley monologues, those were things that Mike had in mind. And when I did my pass on those scripts, I just put brackets, Mike Wright's brilliant monologue, close bracket, and moved on, because he'd already talked to me and said that he knew exactly what he wanted to do with both of those characters and both of their viewpoints. So that is entirely Mike. And
I wonder if that's something he, like, heard from you and entered into his vernacular or something then.
Possibly. I might have picked it up from him. Who knows? I might have picked it up from the show. I mean, I've worked on it long enough and seen it enough. Absolutely. Those two speeches, I know, are very important. And you all being friends of Kate and fans of Mike, you know about his love of Carl Sagan already. If you've seen Life of Chuck, or are going to buckle up to see it, get ready for more of that, which is great. Chuck is probably, Mike has said this, so I feel okay saying it. Well, I'll just couch it that way then. Mike has told me that Chuck is his favorite thing that he's ever done. And Life of Chuck, the Stephen King adaptation of the short story. And yeah, it hits pretty powerfully. And there's a lot in there, that bits and pieces that Mike has sort of toyed with in other stories that he's told, that really shine in that particular adaptation. And yeah, you know, yet again, that's another story all about death and what it's like and the lives we lived before it. And it's a question that I think Mike certainly grapples with. You know, when he needs his answers, he looks to the stars.
Yeah, I don't know how to follow it up with anything.
Aaron's monologue at the end of Midnight Mass, I keep thinking about getting a tattoo. I have not gotten one yet, but that's something I keep coming back to. I am that I am. I think it's just so beautiful. And I also agree. I personally don't really, obviously none of us know what happens when we die, but I am, because I love space and I love the solar. I love the universe. I love the idea that we're all made of star stuff. And when we die, we go back into the universe.
And that sort of goes back to, you know, the old Testament, the Hebrew word, Yahweh, right? I am who I am. The word for God. It's interesting how it does come back to this larger sense of connection. If you can boil God down to something, it's how everything is interconnected in one thing. And that is a beautiful idea that we see echoed through many different religions in many different ways. That last speech, and Kate does it so beautifully, really, I think, nails that feeling of releasing into something. And instead of death being an end, that death is simply an expansion, a return to something vaster than we get to experience when we're just sort of, you know, locked in flesh. It's a beautiful end for that character and a strangely peaceful one given the moment in the story. Also, an interesting monologue given that she drank all the blood, so technically she would be just standing back up if the sun didn't come up. So I thought that was kind of funny.
I thought about that. So she's just burning up over there once all this is done. Well, that's horrifying.
Yeah, we have to cut. Maybe, we cut back to her just screaming on the ground, but we've already had her screaming at the end of an episode, so maybe that would have been too much.
Oh my gosh! Like
when
Riley dies.
Oh, yep, that's the one.
And you're like, it's so sweet. And it's just like, ah.
That's a great cut, isn't it? Yeah, that's one of my favorite of Mike's scene-to-scene cuts is, you know, Riley extends his hand, to Tarbeth, and then and just hard cut to Aaron just screaming in the boat.
I mean,
it's great.
Yeah,
talk about
having faith in somebody, right? To be like, you know what? I'm going to just burn into fire in front of you, Aaron, and you're gonna save the day. Like that's some kind of faith.
The instructions should have been a little more clear, but like for the, you know, the drama of it all.
Yeah. You know, he might have found a better list of things to leave behind. You know,
when you don't got time.
Yes, I believe him when he says he did his best. Sometimes I don't really know what I don't even know how to tell someone how to, like, I don't know, you know, program a TiVo. I don't even know how those things work. So. I don't know how to tell somebody to save an island either. And technically, he's kind of telling her to run, right? He's telling her not to save the island. He's like, you're going to want to, but maybe just don't.
yourself.
He knows her well enough to know that she's going to, which is, you know, I think that's the beauty of that love is how well they know each other, even if they would will each other to make different choices. He accepts that she's going to go back, even if he would much rather that she just rode away.
Also, not just like Riley having faith in Aaron that she was like going to make the right choice, but her having faith in him, because I mean, he, like, they're in a boat together in a confined space, and then he tells her basically like the whole story, and she realizes that he is like, he essentially is like one of those. Can I use the word vampire? I don't know, because it's not really used in the show.
Yeah, absolutely. You can absolutely use the word vampire. It is vampires. Yeah, absolutely.
Because I mean, if I was like, even if I was super close with someone, like if it was my fiance and he was like telling me like, oh, I've been turned into a vampire, I don't know. Like, I think that I might be like, I don't know if I want to be here, because what if you're going to try to, I don't know. So she has to have faith in him that he's not going to harm her.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a beautiful moment in that scene is, you know, when he rows her out into the middle of nowhere, into an isolated place, and he has a history of, you know, addiction, and there's a real danger there for the character, for Aaron. It's a testament to the love that she has for Riley and how well she knows him, to your point, Kelsey, that she acknowledges the danger that she is potentially in and still stays and is just there to hear this person that she loves express what he needs to express and trusts that it isn't going to go in an awful direction. It does, but of course it's an inevitable awful direction and not one of Riley's making. You know, it's it's a release, if anything. But yeah, I really adore that scene and that handoff from one protagonist to another. I think it's elegantly done. There's a book, Venice Underground, that does something very similar that Mike and I had written an adaptation of that never made it over the starting line, unfortunately. But it's Jeff Vandermeer. He wrote it when he was 19. It's
absolute genius.
Yeah, and the story is basically Dante's Inferno by way of Reanimator. Your first protagonist, who you're with for the first third of the book, dies, and then all of a sudden you're with that protagonist's twin sister for 30 pages, and then she gets taken off the board, and then you're with a mutual friend of the two who takes us through the rest of the story. But it hands off protagonists in the most beautiful way that you feel the loss of each one of them and you love the one they hand off to even more for the sacrifice they made to hand off the baton. It's a beautiful balancing act and a hard thing to do, because when you tell an executive we want to kill our protagonist and this is now our protagonist, they don't like that much. They don't respond well. But I'm really glad glad that Vandermeer stuck to it for Venice Underground, and I'm glad that Mike landed it for Midnight Mass.
The trade-off comes at such an interesting moment, too, because backing up, the faith that Aaron has in Riley seems so similar to the faith that she has in God, and are both like things that she has just recently, been reacquainted with, and just has to, even though the, Old Testament God is not kind in any kind of way, and you have to believe that despite all of these bad things, I need to trust you and not be afraid and listen to what you're saying. And I think it mirrors those relationships really, really well.
Yeah, I think if God is love, and we hear that thrown around pretty often, then your faith in love should be equal to your faith in God, right? Absolutely. So it makes perfect sense that she has the willpower to trust in him, and the faith to trust in Riley in that moment, because she loves him and knows that she has loved him in return. She has no reason to doubt.
And it's just an insanely well-written cast of characters in that show.
On behalf of the entire writer's room, from Teresa Sutherland, I'm not going to name everybody, but on behalf of all of us, thank you. And especially on behalf of Mike, we appreciate the kind words and that you connected awkward with the piece.
Yeah, I feel like, wow, Midnight Mass takes up so much of the existential dread that I feel like we've barely gotten to talk about any other project.
it's fair. It's a scary world right now. And
Yeah.
I'm happy to shift gears if you want to. The segue.
Did anyone? I'm sorry. I was just realizing that. Wow, I've been droning on.
Like, obviously, it's a theme that comes up in a lot of works, but I feel like it's just such a, especially faith, like lowercase, uppercase F, is just so prevalent in that piece for so many reasons, and I love that it's written in a way that I think anybody could watch it. I think people who like Riley were not raised Catholic, you could still really relate to it.
Of the shows that I've written on, it's the one that friends of friends most often will get in touch with me and be like, hey, so-and-so showed me Midnight Mass. I just wanted to say I totally got it, and wow, it brought back a lot of memories. And I'm like, my reaction to that is always, it's always I'm so sorry. it's like, clearly, yeah, at some point you knew when to kneel, when to stand, when to sing. Like, those things were ingrained in us at young ages. Those don't go away. I think that was, it was in the writing process, and I think for Mike in terms of filming the mass sequences, that was probably one of the more second nature things, was just knowing the order of the mass, because wow, did we see a lot of them.
I saw one. My mom got baptized and confirmed Catholic once. It was a lot of kneeling and standing up and sitting down, and there's a... I like the ritual of it, but it wasn't for me.
Yeah, it's an hour. It's it can be a long hour, too, depending on who your priest is and where they go with that homily. That can change your whole day. And yeah, you know, we had a really engaging priest when we were young named Father Jim Stack. That was a character that I know that Mike wanted to bring into his original vision for this tale of two priests. We had Monsignor Hogan, who was an elder priest in our parish, who ended up developing, I believe, Alzheimer's or dementia. I was pretty young, so my memories of it aren't too clear. That Father Stack and Monsignor Hogan sort of energy is very much what I think Mike was leaning into with Father Paul, and you know, the older version of him, the younger version of him, and the actual virtue that character possesses, which I think is pretty great. For as flawed as his choices might be, I think that he made what he believed to be good choices, and when he was shown that they were not good choices, was able to course correct, which is what I believe any, you know, person who is in religion for the good of all other people should be able to do, is realize when you're causing harm and course correct. The character that Hamish plays is the priest that I think I would want in the world and want to see more of in the world, minus the part where he tried to turn an entire town into vampires.
Yeah, good intentions.
Yeah, we don't really want that.
No, that is interesting. And it's like, this is the cautionary tale of when you are one of those people, but it just gets to be to a point where it is too late. I'm hoping we don't get there. And I think recently the inauguration happened, and there was a bishop whose name I am blanking on, but did in front of Trump and Vance and their families basically, you know, call this out with them calling themselves religious and then not acting anything like what their religions preach.
Yeah, she's pretty inspiring. And
absolutely.
It was in response to her asking for our leaders to look on, you know, vulnerable people with mercy. It was in response to that I saw that meme of "Do not commit the sin of empathy." It had a picture of her on it, and it was in response to that. So it's, yeah, you know, I was really impressed by what it is she said, and I agree with it wholeheartedly. And I was really gobsmacked to see that reply from someone who is obviously a religious person, because they're talking about the concept of sin. Labeling empathy as sin just feels so backwards in every way that it could be. But yeah, she was absolutely inspiring. It's both heartening to see, but then at the same time, I have to remind myself that if I'm feeling grateful and impressed that a church leader is brave enough to simply mention that LGBTQ people and immigrants deserve mercy, we're really begging for scraps at this point, and we need to raise our standards a little higher. It's nice to have that support, but we might need support that's a bit more vocal and a bit more...
We need a lot more of it from all directions.
Pieces of media like Midnight Mass are so important, because you have these people who are in these communities where they don't see anything outside of their community. People in like very southern Georgia who have never even met like a Muslim, never met like someone of a different color, like a skin. Like, so pieces of media that can really kind of put a mirror back to people are so important. And I think Midnight Mass especially is so topical to what our country and other countries in the world are going through right now.
Yeah, I think that storytelling is a great place to put experience and life lessons and aspirations. And I think stories like these and yeah, you know, in the best possible scenario, they might help someone enact change within themselves to treat other people better. or it might help them treat themselves better. If they recognize something there that maybe is a bit of empathy that they weren't extending to themselves, because I kind of feel like maybe you have to extend that empathy to yourself before you can really give it to everyone else. Yeah, you know, I love storytelling for that, and I've been talking about this a lot. So if you're someone who is listening to this and has heard any other interview where I've used this phrase, I apologize for beating it like a drum. But storytelling as an act of care. Which I believe it is, and I believe it should be, especially in troubling times.
I feel like, yeah, as a writer as well, but as a viewer especially someone who, I don't know, I guess just got into the horror genre and realized how empathetic the people there are, it's nice to, in horror especially, in those stories especially, it's nice to see that and nice to know there are good people behind this that are following through with the things they're trying to teach.
I've been keeping up with Severance, which is one of my favorite shows out there these days.
God, what a good show.
Yeah, I think what it does beautifully is it presents you a duality for these characters, right? There's who they are as with their lived experience as an innie, and then there's who they are with their lived experience as an outie. And this season is finally letting the versions of themselves on the outside understand what's happening to them on the inside. And you're starting to see little moments, little cracks where empathy is stealing in. Even with Helly having this, you know, one of the characters, she on the outside is someone who is... very much not a very caring person. On the inside, you know, she pretty much does care about her friends. She has a line that I was kind of taken aback by, where she says that, you know, we are not the same people and we don't owe each other anything in terms of the inside people and the outside people. But then you watch the outside version of her witness a videotaped moment of the inside version of her having a romantic moment, and you see the cracks and the fissures start to open up. You can hope that there's some empathy in there. There's probably also some jealousy. It's probably complex, and it's probably going to take a season to really crack that open and see how Helly sort of untangles that knot and what she does with it. But I think that when we have these stories of people grappling with these opposing forces of what it is they initially feel with what it is they learn when they allow themselves to see someone else as human and deserving, then those are stories that I can't get enough of. And, you know, I right now Severance gives me that in spades. So I will watch that show for as long as they will keep it running.
Oh yeah. And the like God complex stuff they're talking about with the outies is very, very interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And that sort of corporate worship, you know, for that Keir is very much sort of, you know, an older Elon Musk kind of character, if you think about it in that way. I mean, Musk even has that little insertable head chip, right? That neural link that they're using to, I think a guy who a paraplegic was able to play a video game with that thing.
Insert chip thing or whatever.
Yeah. So, you know, already... We have, you know, billionaires starting to tinker around in people's brains. Who knows where this ends, but that idea of power and resources being something that is worshipped is definitely an American and capitalist ideal that we see all over the place. And right now it's at its peak, right? Like our president is a billionaire. He's staffed the place with millionaires. And the rest of us are, you know, varying levels of either impoverished or, you know, lower class, middle class. And it's just so odd that we've let the people who had all the resources rise to the highest levels of power. And that those highest levels of power have been sort of infiltrated by religious zealot thinking and fundamentalist thinking. So already we have that idea of worshiping billionaires, whether it's culturally or religiously, where we've started to buy back into that idea that if these people have amassed this amount of wealth and this amount of success, then that must be God smiling upon them and not simply them being cutthroat enough to take it from other people who deserve it just as much as they do.
I think it's a lot about people wanting or expecting to be rewarded for that loyalty as well, the same as it like, accept Jesus into your heart as your savior and you'll get to heaven. Accept Donald Trump as your authoritarian leader and you'll also be a billionaire. It's just a lot of like magical thinking happening, and it's very sad to watch the delusion of it all.
Yeah, you know, my current favorite is elect Donald Trump into office and then immediately buy his meme crypto coin, you know? Like, it's the weirdest thing. It's like, wow, what more evidence do you need that this man is entirely full of crap than he's, the first thing he does in office is enrich himself with a meme coin. It's a nothing coin. I'm sorry, I'm ranting. Kelsey, you haven't said something in a minute. I would love to hear your voice. I just want to throw this to you, if that's possible. Kelsey, save us. Get us out of this.
I'm sorry that I've been so quiet. I'm a teacher, and today I had first graders, and so I'm a little worn out. But in defense of, I can't speak for like all teachers, but at least the district that I'm in, we actually are teaching empathy in classrooms. Like, it's very basic, and it's kind of like, how can we be kind, and like, why should we not bite our friends and things like that? But I mean, we're trying. So the next generation will hopefully not think of other people like. So we're trying to do the good work.
But, Kelsey, you are the front lines. If we can have a world with less biting, oh my goodness. Like, no, you don't even know. I'm off. I thank you for your service, honestly.
You would be surprised how much that comes up.
I think I saw something on social media just the other day where I guess some parasocial acquaintance of mine posted a picture of a bite mark on their arm. And was like, this is the first time I have been bitten as a teacher in my classroom. And I was like, wow. For real, just got bit.
Yeah, I
feel like it happens a lot from where I'm standing. My girlfriend, she's a teacher as well, but she works with children with like high developmental disabilities and are all nonverbal, so a lot of like their behavior is communication, and she gets beat up, bitten. It's a mess over there.
So really, like, Kelsey, for you, is the most relatable part of Midnight Mass once everyone starts biting everyone else?
This is super nerdy. Yes, this is super nerdy. But so when I was watching Midnight Mass, right now I'm a sub. So I like it because I can pick up what classes I want. Sometimes you get put places you don't want to be, but you have a little more control. When Midnight Mass came out, I was a middle school teacher in a very, very conservative part of Georgia. I actually finished watching, I watched the last episode of Midnight Mass in my classroom because I woke up early when it dropped to binge it, and I had one episode to go. And so all my planning period, I watched it, and I started screaming at the part at the end to the point where like the people on the classroom on either side were like, what's wrong? And I was like, nah. but the scene, the first school room scene, when we see their schedule and like how like during like harvesting season, or I can't remember how it's worded, but they have school from like 10, it's like 10 to 4. And I remember like pausing it and like looking through like Bev's classes and Aaron's classes. And I was like, man, I want to teach it on Crockett Island. Like I'll deal with the vampires and all that other stuff if I can have that schedule.
Wow. That must be a good schedule for teachers.
I mean look.
Yeah.
Yeah, you work in a what is essentially a battlefield, and it's a battlefield of of tiny enemies that are very cute, very destructive, and also you can't really fight back against.
It's not as bad. I'm mostly sub elementary school now, and it's not as bad. But when I taught middle school, I took a punch. I had chairs thrown at me. A kid threw his phone at me, which like I'm like, that's not smart, because if you break it, you're not going to have your device. so many things, and it got to the point where I was like, no, I just can't do this anymore. And so now I sub and I can pick where I go, and I found a couple schools that I'm very, very happy at and are not like my previous experiences. But yeah, it's rough out there.
It sounds brutal.
The school where all of the Bevkeens lived in Georgia, those children are much worse behaved than your kids now. And I have, like, witnessed this full hand because we've been friends since that move. And just the behavior is so interesting.
It's crazy because people try to tell me, like, so where I am now, I'm in Austin. But the district where I am, it's a wealthier district. And people try to tell me that's why the kids are better behaved. And it's like, no, it is not. Because the district in Georgia, it was all, like, McMansions and stuff like that their parents lived in. I could not afford to live anywhere close to the school where I taught in that state. So those kids, those families were not hurting for resources. And, oh, they were not polite. Like, they were not being taught empathy. So it's like a huge difference.
Yeah, it's wild. And that level of money and comfort sometimes sometimes gives people like a bridge where they don't need empathy. It's a strange thing where they grow up spoiled is the wrong word, but just sort of but I can't think of a better one.
It might almost be the right word.
Yeah. And it's interesting because we couldn't do those like empathy lessons and stuff like that in that district because the parents were all up in arms about you're not indoctrinating my child. And it's like your kids need to learn to like not be rude to people or that you can't just punch someone because outside of school, if you punch someone, you could end up in jail for assault. But here we're like the behavior tends to be a little bit better. These are like the parents that are like, yes, like we like those empathy lessons. It's also politically very different. So that could be why, but it's just the irony.
And you know, the one thing that me and you and all of those rich kids and everyone has in common is that one day we're all going to die and none of it's going to matter.
And we don't know what happens after we do. None of us
and
do.
And who knows? I'm really starting to hope it's nothing. I could use a good nap.
I don't mind nothing. Nothing's fine, you know? Nothing's better than something bad. You know?
So scared of oblivion because at least if something happened, I'd still be around. But at this point, everything's been so bad that why would I want to be after I get through it the first time?
If there is something like afterwards, you know, we're going to get there. And the pharaohs, they're since they took everything with them, they're already going to have like franchises. Like we're going to be lower class in the afterlife That's already true. Because of all the folks who got in on the ground floor. So,
although one reason why I really hope that there is an afterlife is because my grandma, she passed away in 2018. So she got to experience a little bit of Trump's first presidency. And she swore that when she died, she was going to come back and haunt him. So I hope for her sake that there is an afterlife so that she is getting to do something right now.
Kelsey, can you write this short story? Can you write the story of Trump being haunted by your grandma? I will read it. I will read it. I will send it to people. I will try to get it published. I think that sounds amazing. And I want to know your grandmother. Like, please, put her on the page and let her live her dream.
She was a wild. She had a Twitter account at one point, but she didn't know how to tweet, so she would just tell me what she wanted to say, and it was usually random, but one time she said, I want you to tweet that Donald Trump is a mean person, and then 2 hours later she called my mom and said, I need Kelsey to delete that, because what if he shows up at my door?
Oh, man. I laugh, but I mean, honestly, these days, what if? Like, yeah, that...
Yeah, wow. She needs the security of being a ghost so that he can't do anything.
Yeah, I
respect
get it.
That.
Yeah,
I do
so
too.
Riley, I think you need to write that story. I can dictate it, like I can tell it to you, and then because Riley's the Riley can write
send
it.
Send me your grandma's Twitter account, and maybe we can do something together.
I've been trying to find her handle because she would like tweet random stuff. Like one time it was like, "I want you to say don't drink bleach, kids," and it was just so weird.
Unfortunately, a lesson that. At one point, kids did need.
Yeah, yeah. Like that was actually a salient rebuttal to the Trump administration's specific stance on, you know, how they were going to deal with COVID. That's incredible. Your grandma was fighting the fight, and I'm sorry to hear of her passing, but she sounds like an incredible woman.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I think she would be like, she probably would have had like a heart attack from all the stuff that's going on now politically. So maybe it's for the best, but.
Yeah, I've had like three already today during this interview.
Oh, it's just constant anxiety attacks happening in here. Okay. Speaking of that, though, kind of segueing, I did have one more relevant question, and I would like to bring up a show that I controversially think ended at the exact right time, The Midnight Club. Not a fan that it got canceled, but also, like, you know, it's a show about kids dying. Stop torturing those kids. There is a very, like, definitive, yes, there is probably something after death answer in The Midnight Club, in an episode that my friend Jamie may have written or had to do with. But I don't know. I feel like, Jamie, what are your opinions, or like, what is the difference between writing that kind of answer versus writing something like Midnight Mass, where the end of life is so ambiguous?
First, I want to thank you for your bravery for saying that about Midnight Club. And
great show. Love those kids.
Yeah. All right. Oh, you and I can be a team of two. I agree, actually. I know I'm sad that it didn't get a season two for the cast, for the crew, for, you know, for employment purposes. In terms of story, Midnight Club for me ends, and I'm going to go into a spoiler here, exactly when the book ends. And the book ends with a revelation that there is something to this afterlife. There's a small statue that is healed in the book. And then in the book, you actually get a reincarnated storyline. You get Ilanka and Kevin in a different life, having been reincarnated.
Aliens?
Yeah. It's like in space or something. And you get a brief glimpse at that. And then there's a hope and a joy there, because you realize that all of these kids died, but there was an afterlife, and there's also reincarnation. So though this particular life for them was abbreviated, it was never the end. It was just one brief chapter in a much longer experience. And I found that was enough. Just the statue. I didn't even really need the sci-fi reincarnation. Just the mended statue for me was enough of an answer that the show offered that gave me comfort for those kids. Writing on that show was tough. And to your point, I also think that having multiple seasons of kids dying in a hospice is a really tall order. And I think maybe just having the one was enough, especially because the episode that I did get to write was Anya's last moments in her own head when she dies, which play out where she lives an entire life, a lifetime in her head, most of which is plagued with the same kind of things that she was plagued with in life, which insecurity and loneliness and alienation. And then it's only through, you know, the voices of her friends in her final moments that tell her a story as an act of care and give her a fantasy of a better life that, given the life she lived, she wasn't even able to conjure and convince herself was possible. That to me was a beautiful opportunity to explore that. After that, I didn't really have much left to say with the show. I think that knowing where we were headed with Midnight Club, knowing that we were going to get that statue moment, that mended statue moment, that answer, made me feel a little better. Because this is a story about kids, and as audience members, we're watching kids dealing and grappling with these unknowable questions. And it is a fiction, and maybe we can give these particular characters an answer and give them hope at the end of this. And I think that was certainly the intention of Christopher Pike when he wrote the novel. So we got to stay true to that. For Midnight Mass, it was much more liberating, because Midnight Mass was an exploration of these things without a definitive answer, which means that you can pose many different theories. You can ask the question a million times. You can have a character pass away feeling like they've found an answer, but still know that for every other character, that answer remains elusive. Eren's belief is enough for her. But that's not to say that anyone else will die with peace. I mean, Bev practically buries herself in the sand because she's so afraid of judgment. And then, you know, another two characters are greeting death with ritual, right? Hassan and his son are out there in prayer. And it is a very active form of prayer and a ritualistic form of prayer. For Father Paul, it's a moment of family reunion in death and of claiming for an instant a road that he'd neglected to take in his youth that might have led to a fuller, happier life, which is to cast off the cloth, to embrace the love that was offered to him and before him, and to embrace his daughter and the woman that he loved. And they get to have that for a second, even though they're all passing. I think having that ambiguity as to what comes next allows each of those characters' beliefs to be the reality. And we get that catharsis with them. If we had an answer at the end of Midnight Mass that just said, yes, there's a heaven and a hell, and they'll be judged Christianically as to who gets sorted where, it would nullify all of those beautiful moments. I think what makes Midnight Mass so liberating and so beautiful is the ambiguity and is how each one of these characters greets that ambiguity in that final moment before the sun comes in that very last episode. With Midnight Club, after Anya, I was good. I didn't need to see another one of those kids meet death.
The thing that I did get most from the Midnight Club was hope, and the thing I got most from Midnight Mass was a sort of catharsis. And I think those two shows definitely both serve the exact purpose that they were meant to.
So I'm so glad.
You for them.
Very affirming to hear.
Thank you
for your work, Jamie.
Oh, hey, thank you to you all for watching and engaging and having these conversations. And on behalf of the writer's room and everyone involved in the productions, we just really are so thrilled to be able to share that and to talk with you all about it. This is the whole point. You know, it's made to do exactly this. It's made so that we can have these conversations. And yeah, thank you. It means the world.
You're welcome.